This is NPR Specials. Actor Frank Langella began his acting career on stage over 40 years ago at Lincoln Center in New York. Since then, he's become one of the most respected actors on stage as well as on screen. In 2009, Langella earned an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of former U.S. President Richard Nixon in the film Frost Nixon. Langella, who recently celebrated his 72nd birthday, is shooting a new film in Berlin, a thriller called Unknown White Male, due out next year. He recently stopped by the American Academy in Berlin to speak with the executive director, Gary Smith, about sustaining a meaningful career in the entertainment industry.
Well, this is a very special honor to meet Frank Langella, have you at the American Academy in Berlin. First of all, I want to thank Helena Finn and the staff of the embassy. When we heard that you were filming here, we were very excited for many, many reasons, all different reasons. I'm going to ask some questions about people you've worked with, about your career, about theater. When this institution began, Volker Sterndorf had worked with Arthur Miller and Richard Holbrooke, who was the real force of nature who created this institution, found this villa, had the idea, recruited Arthur Miller to come the first semester and be one of the first fellows, and then he was always very generous and close to us in many ways in the subsequent years before he died. Not just to work with Arthur Miller, but to recreate one of his great plays, because it's a very different play under the same name, in a way. And if you could just tell us a little bit about that. I remember he would always go to interesting productions of his plays, but I never saw him as involved as you experienced.
Well, I did after the fall in 1976, just before I did Dracula, in a small theater in Massachusetts called the Williamstown Theater Festival. And Arthur came to see it and was very, very complimentary. Very Arthur, though, very kind of laid back, sort of. And he came backstage afterwards. And when you're in Williamstown, Massachusetts, everybody sort of lives together in a big house, and you have a bedroom, and you go down to the kitchen at night after a show, and you sit around a big table. So I said to Arthur, do you want to come back and sit with the rest of us? He said, oh, sure, I got nothing else to do. So he came back, and Arthur was catnip to women, incredibly attractive to women all of his life, and he to them. And he came. I remember he came into the kitchen, and all the girls in the company were just vibrating. And he looked at the prettiest one and said, come over here. And he patted the chair like this, like she was a big kitten, you know. And she sat down next to him. And, of course, we sat for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours. And he told great stories about Kazan and his youth and stuff, and offered some interesting notes to me about the character. But a small piece of history is that when I was about 22 years old, I was in a thing called the Lincoln Center Training Program. And After the Fall had just been written, Marilyn had just died, Arthur was denying it was about Marilyn, and they were casting it in New York, and I was part of the theater group that Arthur had written the play for. So I sat at 23 years old in a room with Arthur Miller, Elia Kazan, and Robert Whitehead, who was a very important producer at the time, as the great actress, young actresses of the day, came to read for this play that no one had heard of and no one had read yet. And it was the story of a man in his middle 40s, Arthur, going through a crisis and married to a beautiful young woman. And I was 23. So I kept sitting there reading the lines. I was asked to read the leading role to cue the actresses. And I kept thinking, what's this guy's problem? I don't understand. I don't understand this problem of his. It made no sense to me, of course, until I got to be that age. And after I did it, it went away. The production went away. And one morning I woke up and I thought that play deserves to be in New York again. So I picked up the phone, emboldened as I was, And I rang Arthur and said, will you give me the rights to After the Fall? And he said, what do you want to do with it? And I told him. And he said, sure, which is one of the things you could do with Arthur Miller. He was very easy about that sort of thing. He gave it to me for $1. And therein came 3 or 4 months of my life in which Arthur Miller came to my house every single night. And I had a new wife at the time. She made us a meal. We ate it. We went into my little study and we took the play apart, page by page by page, and removed a great deal of the propaganda about the camps and the political stuff involving Kazan, and got it down to the human drama between Arthur and Marilyn. And it was a pretty good success when we did it off Broadway. He was a very interesting. You know, his nickname was God. It's just what his family called him. They called him God. And the other thing I remember about Arthur was that in the intense year I spent with him, and I spent a great deal of time preparing the play, doing it. He loved the production, so he was around all the time. So we were together constantly. He never paid for one meal. Which is very much a writer. Uh-huh. Very much a writer, yeah.
And then you went to work with another iconic American figure, not as well known, but I was actually collecting his books in Texas, Edward Gorey.
Oh, yes.
And what was that like? I mean, I can't imagine.
Well, Edward was a really genuine eccentric, and the first time I met Edward was at a photo shoot, and I have the photo that they took, and I was 37 or 38. I don't think he was much older than me at the time. And he looked and was just terrified. The photograph, he's like this, just standing there, and I'm sort of smiling with my arm around him. He, and I told you before this evening started that I'm moving house, and in my boxes of memorabilia, I found the original Edward Gorey drawings of me as Dracula that he did. I looked at them and thought, my God, they're quite valuable. And I framed them, and they're wonderful. The little black and white sketches, the way he drew tiny little things this big with smudges and fingerprints. But the thing I remember most about him was the first preview of Dracula before an audience saw it. We were sitting in the theater, and the producers wanted Edward to see the set for the first time under lights, and the curtain went up, and there was the Edward Gorey set of Dracula reproduced in large form, and he burst into tears and ran out of the theater and never came back. And he said, I sit over at a table with it like this, drawing these tiny little things, and the notion of seeing his sets that big was impossible for him. He never, ever returned to see the play. But he kept the royalty checks.
You've written occasionally about your work, and in 1986 you wrote an article for the New York Times about acting, actors and their demons, which I should give my son because it'll perhaps discourage him. The fear of unemployment, the anxiety of keeping up images, and the self-loathing that sometimes comes with the desperate wanting to be liked in a figure. How is this? Is this true as true now, 20 years later, than it was as it was then?
Do you mean think when about, I wrote it? Or?
Yes. Do you think of acting differently now?
Well, I think that the essential truth of an actor is that he's, to various degrees, desperate for love. And the older we get, hopefully, the smarter we get, the less neurotic that need is, the less compulsive it is. I had an acting coach in college who said, you should act in spite of your neurosis, not because of it. But most actors who are honest will tell you that they became actors because they were in some way emotionally crippled as young people. I couldn't function very well as a child. I wasn't very good in the real world. When I got older, it was very hard for me to talk to girls, and difficult for me to function. But the minute I stepped from that to this, I felt liberated and free and as if I were home. Other people feel it when they pick up a paintbrush or when they, you know, pick up an instrument and play, or when great singers who are in this room sing. And that sense of being able to produce and do something that gives people pleasure gives you, if you are the kind of neurotic mess I was, it gives you a sense of belonging and a place. But then as you get older, if you're smarter, and I'm afraid a lot of actors aren't, you understand that it's a skill, it's a craft, and you can take what is difficult in you, what is lonely in you, sad in you, frightened, and you can mold it, and you can turn it into art. A lot of actors never quite get over the initial desire to be loved and carry it through into their 50s and 60s, which is why you always read about actors who behave badly and get drunk or demand incredible things, because they never quite give up the baby in them.
Well, you've worked with a number of great directors throughout your career.
Many.
On the stage. And as you've, and I want to ask you to talk about them. When you wrote this article, the directors seemed to loom very large. You wrote about how they could crush your soul, a director can crush an actor's soul, and the dependencies of a director. But of course, you're one of our greatest stage actors in America. And of course, directors will be very happy to have the privilege of working with you. Has that changed? Have your relationships with directors changed? What are your best experiences? This is the kind of question one has to ask. What are your best experiences working with a director? And if you wanted to tell us, what's your worst experience of a director?
Well, actually, the greatest experiences I've had, and I have had off the top of my head, in film, Adrian Lyne and Ron Howard and George Clooney and Roman Polanski and on and on it goes, a great French director called René Clément. I suppose the greatest thing a director can give an actor is a sense of safety, a sense that he's not going to damage you in any way, belittle you, or diminish you. Because it's, no one can understand quite what it's like to be the one to step in front of the lens. I'm not making acting out to be any more difficult or any more special than any other profession, but it has a very particular demon, and that is that while you're sitting and talking and the makeup person's coming and fixing and the director's fighting with you about something and someone else is doing this, and the minute the director yells action, everybody else can stand in the back and have a cigarette or they can cool off or get a drink, but you have to go in front of the lens. You're the one that has to put your soul into that camera, which means that you've got to take everything that's happened right before you do it and, again, make it art. And the best directors are the people who understand that, who understand that you need, in order to do that, you need to feel terribly safe and terribly sure of the territory. And if you don't have a director who does that for you, you have to do it for yourself. You have to be relentlessly selfish about putting into that lens exactly what you believe is necessary for your character. I'm at a point now, I mostly was, but I can really forget everything. But I treat the lens like a mistress. It's like a woman you're making love to. You are really saying, you're the only thing there is in the world for me right now, and I want to put all my heart and soul into you. And then everything around behind that lens disappears. And it helps that I'm blind as a bat. So without my glasses, I really can't see anybody around the lens.
And of course, we were just debating earlier today. I mean, many think of you as a stage actor, but of course, you're a stage actor. You've also worked in quite a few extraordinary film roles that you've given us. The difference is so vast, film, stage, and maybe if you could give us a couple of examples, like the Nixon, this character that somehow you internalized him in a way that if you go on YouTube, like Joschka Fischer did before we presented the movie in Berlin for the first time, it seemed more authentic, your Nixon with David Frost, than the YouTube excerpts of the real interview. How would you describe the difference between the Nixon you portrayed on stage and the Nixon in the film?
Well, the first time when I was asked to play him, I said no, not out of that thing where the actors always say, well, I turned it down. It wasn't that. It was, I didn't really think he was in my particular bag of tricks. I had no clue how I would play him or in what way. I just thought we were so far apart, which only made me want to do it finally, because as you get older, it's the things that frighten you really that should attract you and make you do them, not the things that you know you can do easily. So I called a lot of people. I called Barbara Walters, I called Mike Wallace, I called Henry Kissinger, I called everybody who knew him or interviewed him or worked with him, Frank Gannon, everybody. I got a list and I just boldly picked up the phone and gathered as much information as I could. And then I decided, okay, I think I'll just jump and see what happens. And I went to the Museum of Radio and Television, and a very lovely lady there, I said, do you have anything on Richard Nixon? And she said, do we have anything on Richard Nixon? And she wheeled in this cart of DVDs that was like 40 deep, and I thought, oh, what have I gotten myself into? And it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and I just kept putting in DVDs, and I had a big yellow notepad, and I watched, oh, he does this with his hands, and he does that. And I kept watching him. And this went on for hours and hours and hours, and I kept thinking, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have the ability to do. I can't play him. And a lucky accident happened, which is what I live for as an actor. I live for the prop falling down or somebody messing up or I mess up, and then I go, oh, when something happens. I went to the bathroom and I put it on pause. So this is to answer your question about what did I play as opposed to what he was. When I came back from the bathroom, I sat down and I leaned forward to press play, and by accident I pressed slow-mo. And there he was. I started to go to play, and then I went, no, wait a minute. And there he was. It was as if I was looking deep into his soul. Because in the regular time, I was watching what he does. Like we watch Obama now, you watch Hillary Clinton, you're watching them carefully, but it's been my experience that no one in public life, no one is who they are. In other words, if you're standing in the dark with your President Obama or Hillary Clinton or Nixon or me or anybody who's well-known, I'm not putting myself in their class, but I'm a bit well-known, before you walk out of the dark into the light, unconsciously, something clicks in you and you're going to put the face that you want the public to see. It's not necessarily who you are. And when I watched him in slow motion, I saw fear, I saw paranoia. I mean, things we saw in full time, but in slow motion, they were tremendously evident to me. And then I went, again, another lucky accident. I had to go to California on another film, and I had about 6 hours, and I called the Nixon Library and spoke to the curator and said, I'm nearby, can I come over? And he said, yes. And I went up there not knowing that Nixon's childhood home was there. And he gave me the key, so to speak. And I went into this little house that would fit in this room, and I climbed up stairs that were no wider than this chair to his bedroom, expecting to walk into a room. And what I walked into was a tiny little box with eaves about this high that my head hit, two little beds where four boys had grown up. And I sat on his bed and looked out the window. At the window, I could see the helicopter when he left after his resignation. And I sort of imagined what it was like from birth to 9 to live in this tiny little house with your parents. And your father slapping you in the back of the head all the time and telling you that your brother Harold was the real looker and was going to get girls, and all those elements sort of went into a big pot. And then one of the most interesting things about him to me was that he fell in love with Pat as a virgin, and she was a virgin, and she wanted nothing to do with him, so he offered to become her driver when she went out on dates. And he drove her around on dates with other boys, you know. Now, this is a man who really thought he was nothing. He ended up marrying and deflowering the woman he loved, and he became president of the United States. So that kind of extraordinary combination of things makes him, to me, the most fascinating psychological figure of the 20th century as a president.
Well, the remarkable thing, of course, about that performance is that you juggle all those aspects of his personality, and we felt them all. We saw the nether side, but yet you made us feel compassion for him in some ways, which is deeply troubling to some of us, especially to Joschka Fischer.
Well, Frank Gannon, I asked everybody I interviewed, I asked Barbara Walters to give me one impression of him, and she said, he walked as if he had no genitals. And I said, well, that's too much for me to overcome. But Frank Gannon, I asked Frank Gannon what it was that he remembered about him, and he said, I remember the boss every night at the, wherever he was, what was the town, not Whittier, but his private house. He said, I would walk by his office, and he'd be sitting with his belt open, his pants open, his hand on his belly, his bad phlebitis leg up, with a scotch in his hand, and he'd have Victory at Sea playing full volume. He said, that was my memory of him, that quality. And I never meant to make you feel sympathetic. I meant to make you feel empathetic towards him. Frank said to me just before our last long conversation, please don't play him as a drunk and a crook. And I said, no, I have no intention of doing that. I have no intention of judging his behavior, which in certain respects was, of course, absolutely heinous.
No,
I just wanted the man to, and I also kept thinking every time I walked on the set or on stage, his daughters are going to see this. His daughters are going to see this. So I wanted to give him the respect of being a human being.
Yeah. No, I mean, we really felt we peered into his soul through you, that extraordinary performance. I just have a few more questions, and then we have some questions from the audience. But, you know, you're, as others here, Scott Katya, you're playing, you're doing films, you're doing theater at the same time. I assume you can choose now what you want to do. Is it one that you prefer? How do you maintain these two very different worlds?
Well, anybody will tell you, I'm sure the fellow artists in this room will tell you, you're never in a position to choose, never. An actor is not, no performer is it makes choices. Basically, you're waiting, and then you're trying to pick amongst the least embarrassing thing. am I right? Yes. Yeah, you just say, well, okay, that one, that on my deathbed, that one won't be, no. I won't be too embarrassed to say I said that line. Because artists are not in charge. I mean, you're in charge of yourself, and you're in charge of what you comes out of your throat and what comes out of your heart as an actor, but you're really not in charge of your career in the way people think you are. You're hoping that people will come and present something to you that you can do with dignity and respect and excitement and love, but sometimes you can't. Sometimes you must take something that it's less than you'd like it to be because your children are in private schools or because you have to, you know, you have to figure out if you're married, as I was once, to a Jewish American princess. You have to figure out how you could afford the mortgage. But for the most part, I've taken the advice of a director I met when I was a young actor who said, if people hear your name, you should hope and want them to associate it with quality. So try all your life. You're going to have to take a part in a movie or do a play that's commercial in order to do these, pay these bills. But for the most part, try to do things of quality. And I've tried very hard to do that. And every once in a while, of course, you have to do something that's less than you'd like.
If you're a Jewish American prince, this is a pretty good gig, by the way, as I am. So I hope that what you're doing now in Berlin and Potsdam is one of these quality projects. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now?
Well, it's a commercial picture. It's actually a wonderful picture to work on. I love Bruno Ganz and I love Liam Neeson very much, but it's a thriller. It's not a work of art. It's a great, wonderful popcorn thriller, you know. It's about a man who, in brief, falls down, bumps his head, wakes up, and keeps trying to tell people who he is, and they keep saying, "You're not that person. This is that person. Somebody else is that person." And we discover through the movie that he has woken up and thinking that he is the spy that he's been pretending to be before he hurt his head. And he's not really that spy either. So it's why it's called Unknown White Male. He thinks he's his alias, and he's not. And I'm his best friend. That's basically what it is.
You're listening to NPR Specials on NPR FM Berlin 104.1. Our guest is stage and screen actor Frank Langella. He recently sat down with American Academy director Gary Smith to discuss his career and life after an Oscar nomination. After the break, more with actor Frank Langella. This is NPR FM Berlin.
This week on This Canadian Life, a moose is loose.
He just go out of the door there and we never see him again, you know, not ever.
Moose lips on This Canadian Life. Better yet, listen to the show every week on NPR Worldwide.
This is NPR FM Berlin 104.1. In 1968, Frank Langella made his stage debut at Lincoln Center, playing a young William Shakespeare in the show A Cry for Players. Since then, the actor has won multiple Tony Awards and an Oscar nomination for his work in the 2008 film Frost Nixon. Now, we return to a conversation with Frank Langella at the American Academy in Berlin.
I once had a friend years ago who had been the drama critic of the Financial Times, and he refused to see films. He thought it was somehow a perversion of the craft. Can you talk about the difference in the two media of being an actor? Films are sometimes made in little pieces. You don't have a continuity. How does it feel as an actor in these two different...
Well, if you'd asked me the question when I was... 22 instead of 72, I would have had a different answer. I would have answered the way he did, which is really narrow-minded and rather foolish. Film acting is now as exciting to me as stage acting. And the reason it is because the way we were discussing Nixon is the possibility of being able to take a moment in a man's life, let's say it's Nixon or even Skeletor, which is something I love doing, and being able to put it into a lens, a piece of humanity that other people can watch and identify with or feel moved by or excited by, and have it be there, one, forever, but also have it be there like this, is thrilling. And when you're on stage, it's thrilling in another way to be able to take that moment and sail it all the way back to the last person in the last row. It's two different skill sets. And it requires as much commitment from you it's one is neither higher nor lower than the other. It's just the intimacy of film, which now means more to me. I think it's because I'm older, and the energy required to do a stage performance of that size every night is enormous now. The notion that I can just land something maybe with the raise of an eyebrow or a gruff turn of a head that you'll get, as opposed to maybe the person in the back missing it. But acting is acting, whether you're doing it on television or film or same with singing, same with any art. You have to learn your lines, you have to know what they mean, and then you have to mean them when you say them. And it doesn't matter what the medium is. It only matters, the only thing that matters is that it's truthful. If you're not being truthful, it doesn't matter whether the camera's right there or whether it's far away. And also there's this notion that the camera doesn't lie. It absolutely does. It lies like crazy. So you have to be honest. But I love them. I love all forms of it now. I don't have a favorite anymore.
My question is regarding the scripts you're getting. Are they getting better? Are they getting worse? And the question related to that, from an actor's point of view, what has changed the most dramatically in filmmaking over the years and decades?
Well, let me see. I was nominated for an Academy Award last year. The ceremony was, I think, about now. I lost. And between that night and this night, I have received the worst group of scripts I have ever, ever gotten in my life. Only last week, actually, two scripts arrived. I went, oh my God, it was like I was had been in a desert and suddenly there was the oasis. Finally, two scripts arrived that were literate and intelligent and exciting, and there were two characters, and there they were, back to back in the same envelope. Two characters I wanted to play and could play that had richness and dimension. But you would think, anybody would think, well, that happens and you're on top of the world and every great... First of all, there aren't that many great scripts. There are fewer and fewer competitors because actors my age are collapsing around me. So maybe I'll get a role, you know, from some actor who's infirmed in some way. But no, I would say that they're terrible. And most of them are terrible. And that's nothing to do with me or my career. It has to do with the fact that our culture is getting worse and worse and worse, you know. Things are, we don't have the great writers the way we had Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller and William Inge and Edward Albee, and on it goes. People are expecting less and artists are producing less to unfortunately meet those rather sad expectations. Every once in a while, though, a great script comes my way, and today I can say it did, but 2 days ago I would have said, nope. Yes?
Well, first of all, Frank, thank you for being so authentic and honest for someone who's in the movie business, so I appreciate that. You just mentioned the character that you probably might want to play. If you were to choose that single most character that you could still play for the remainder of your life, who would that be? I mean, obviously you get that question quite frequently.
No,
it's not going to be another president. So.
You mean a fictional character?
Either or, stage, fiction or not.
Well, I don't think it would be a character. I think it would be, I don't think it would, I can't name a specific person, but I can sort of tell you that as you get into these years, maybe this is just me, you sort of begin to have a very strong desire to be known. By that I mean a certain amount of being an actor to me is mystery and danger. I think those two qualities are essential to be a great artist. You must never give every single thing to an audience. You should always hold something back. You should be the animal in the jungle they like to watch. But now I would think that it's the qualities of humanity mean a great deal to me. The notion that I will play people who are wrestling with giant themes. I've always been attracted to epic characters, characters like Nixon who are dealing with sort of thunderous emotions. So that means a lot to me. But now I want to keep on playing men who are deeply and profoundly involved with the fundamental things of life. You know, who loves me? Who do I love? What is it? What am I pitting myself against in this world? I have a finite amount of time left. Can I find roles in which I can express what the loneliness of old age is like, what losing someone you love is like, what watching your children go away is like, what divorce, all those, you know, the fundamental things that we all deal with. That attracts me more than anything else, more than the so-called glamorous parts I used to love to play. I still would like them, but you're asking me my heart's desire, and it would be those kinds of parts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Thanks. Yes.
Good evening. Very excited talking to you.
Thank you.
So I'm an actress myself.
I know you are.
And,
can't miss it.
I love very much the when you said earlier that we, or you as an actor, of course you have to wait. Mm. We can't choose, even if it's you. And so my question is, because this is something I'm struggling with since a couple of years, would you consider yourself as an artist? Because as an actor, the way I understand it is that we are working in the performance arts and the reproductive arts. So there's someone else writing the script, kind of giving birth to a character by inventing it. So what all we can do is giving our lifetime, our tears, our sweat, our breath. So my question actually is, would you consider yourself as an artist? Is acting art?
Oh, yes, I'm profoundly. For this reason, when he writes it, it's just on a page. And when the composer writes it, it's just little black dots. But when you act it and you sing it and I act it, it elevates it to what human beings come to the dark to see. We are the vessels for the writer or the composer. We are the people who take it and interpret it and show it, because other human beings are sitting in the dark, desperately wanting not just to be entertained, but to learn. And I don't mean learning, because acting, because being in the theater or singing, it's not a message. If you want a message, you know, go to the library and look it up. But when you go into a room and people are performing, you just want to be moved. That's really all you want. And they can't do that without us. And I think it's a privilege to be an actor. I think there's nothing about it in any way, shape, or form that I find miserable or difficult, even with all the pain of it. It's just a privilege, and I'm sure you feel that when you're singing great roles and when you're acting great roles. You're up there, the vessel for the writer. And the more you think of yourself as the vessel for the primo artist, which is the one who wrote it down, the freer you can be, the less self-conscious you can be. Does that answer your question?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, keep going.
So when you start preparing yourself, so you finally came to decide, I'm going to play Nixon or whatever, and you do the research, you do the preparation for yourself, and you know, learn more and more, and you start to create the character. And you find out the background, even if it's a real person or if it's a fiction person. So you all of a sudden you get closer to this person. Or it's in a way you step towards to that person and the person comes to you. So somewhere in the middle you meet, mm-hmm. and this is how you create, well, if I may say this. But sometimes, doesn't a situation take place where you know so much about the character and you don't have the situation, or let's say the scene, where you can show it because it's not written? So you're always, in a way, limited to the space the script gives you.
No, you're in fact liberated. What you are is liberated, because there's no right in artistry. There's only the effort. There's no getting it right. There's only going for it. If we're getting it right, then just about almost anybody could do it if they could figure out the formula. What you're doing as an artist, if you're an actor or a singer or a musician, is striving, always, always striving, always looking to uncover another human moment, another discovery. So it's never, ever finished. I played Nixon 322 times on stage and hundreds of times in the movie because Ron Howard likes to do a lot of takes. So some of the takes you saw were take 26, 29, 33. Every one of those performances and every one of those takes required me to go right to the bottom and keep telling the truth and keep searching for the truth. And I'm not making myself out to be a great artist. I'm just saying that to me is artistry. When you're constantly searching, when you don't think, oh, I know how to do this. This is, I've got this character, I can do this. And, or you go on automatic. It's constantly, constantly looking for it.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much.
I don't think I sold her on that. But yeah. Huh? That's not what she was talking about. Oh, well, then re-say the question.
She was saying, what if the script didn't allow you to communicate the character you study? Do you then feel trapped? Isn't that sort of what you said? I thought that's what she was saying.
Well, how could the script not allow you to communicate a character if the character you're creating is there for you? In other words, Peter Morgan wrote Richard Nixon. I then went and did a great deal of research, but if the groundwork for him weren't on the page, I couldn't do it. Now, if you're asking me if you have lesser scripts than that, if you don't have the riches of that character, what do you do? Then you have to call upon all sorts of, you have to call upon your imagination and your skill and your artistry to fill the character out as much as you can with the limited words you've been given. Is that a better? Have you met the two of you? Does that make it more sense?
Hello, Mr. Langella. My name is Arturo Castro. I'm a stage director. I gotta say, I'm a huge fan of your work, and it's actually too good to be true to be here tonight. I have a question about two previous movies you did. One movie being Dracula, back in 79. I saw this movie as a young boy, I was 12 years old, and it's still one of my favorite movies to this very day. And I think it's a marvelous performance. When it was like 2 years later, I saw a movie which you made, it's called Masters of the Universe, and you played Skeletor. And by then, you even gained more respect. In retrospect, I want to say that, of course, the performance I value higher is Dracula. But what do these two movies mean to you? I mean, Dracula to me is, if I speak about acting or directing, is the essence of how good things can get, how you are able to make to capture a part and take us to a land where fantasy comes in, and it's at the same time totally believable, and you really believe in those characters.
Thanks. Well, I when I hear action or when I walk out on a stage, there's a certain element of mystery. I don't know, something happens to me. I can't explain it. I've done all my work, I've done my research, I have skill, I'm technically certain, but something happens. Happens, and I can become whoever it is I need to become lost in it, but somehow maintain my technical abilities. And it's a quality I need and value in me, because I can really believe totally in what I'm doing. Dracula was a play I'd done for a year on Broadway, and I was very, very unhappy. This actually refers to what the lady was asking me about, what do you do in circumstances that aren't the best. I was very unhappy making the film because I couldn't get the director to really understand the gothic romance of the character. He just wanted the gore and all of that. So the making of Dracula was a terrible battle between the studio and me and the director. They constantly were sending people to try to get me to wear fangs and wolf's eyes and do all the stuff that you're used to seeing. And I kept saying, why did you make the film with me? I wanted to make him a romantic, dark, mysterious figure who doesn't do the normal vampire things. So the movie's schizophrenic in that there's a great deal of romance in it, but there's a lot of slop over of the usual Hammer stuff. But now I've seen it recently, and it's a better film than I thought it was at the time. Masters of the Universe was a complete, total commercial job. That's what it was. And I find that when I take a job like that, which was truly because my son desperately loved He-Man, and I thought he would be so thrilled that his father was Skeletor, and he promptly fell asleep when I showed it to him. You know, it's like that. But I thought to myself, oh God, I'm going to play Skeletor. Really, am I really going to do this? So I went to, who wrote the book about the myth of man, the famous Joseph
Campbell.
Oh, yeah. So I went to that book and I rewrote Skeletor, taking all of Campbell's lines. So I would look at this Dolph Lundgren, who was this big blonde piece of meat playing He-Man. And I would never tell anybody what I was going to do. So I would say, tell me about the loneliness of good He-Man. Is it equal to the loneliness of evil? Which is a great line. It's Joseph Campbell, you know? So, and I thought, the four-year-olds are going to love this. But in the end, I love Skeletor. I love him in the film because everything I say is from Joseph Campbell. And I find that if I take something that is really pretty crappy, you think about it, the movie was not really a great movie. But if I am going to play that, I'm going to play it with every ounce of commitment that I did with either Dracula or Nixon or a Shakespeare. And I tried to make Skeletor into an epic villain for that reason. But very often, what takes place in the making of a movie is so far away from what any of you would imagine it to be. What happens right before action, the circumstances on the set of a film are astounding. It's always a battlefield. And sometimes it's a loving battlefield and everybody likes each other. And sometimes it's just nothing but misery. It has nothing to do with the outcome of the film. I've been on film sets that were love fests from beginning to end and they were disastrous films. And I've been on films where people loathed each other, couldn't wait to get away, and people won Oscars in them and they got nominated for things. So you don't know, you can't tell.
But it's good.
Somebody back there wants. Yes.
Yeah, I had a question. First of all, I also want to say I'm a very great fan of the movie Dracula, Mr. Lengele. I think you should be very proud of that film because I think it's the best performance or the best interpretation of the character of Dracula I've ever seen. But the question that I have is, because I'm shooting films for television here, and if I would do 30 takes in a scene, the producer would kill me actually on set in front of the crew. So I'm curious, is there any really substantial difference from take to take when you're afforded the luxury to have 30 takes or more with Ron Howard? So is
there's
there
a difference. From my point of view, it's it requires every ounce of skill I have to give the director what he wants. I've had three directors in the last 10 years or so who like lots of takes. Adrian Lyne, when I did Lolita, Roman Polanski, when I did a movie called The Ninth Gate, and Frost Nixon for Ron Howard. They like to do it over again and over again. They would do what we're doing now with a master camera, then they would come in and do a two-shot of us, then they would do you, then they would follow each actor, and I was required to do it every time.
Right. But it's because of the coverage and the technical adjustments. Yeah. But is there
also... On the other hand, you have Clint Eastwood, you have George Clooney, you have a number of wonderful directors. I haven't worked with Clint, but a number of wonderful directors who are very happy after take one or take two. If they've got what they want, they will often say to you, would you like to do another one? And I will often say no. I mean, the director I'm working with now is perfectly happy with one take, and then he does another one to cover it. But there's a great story about Clint Eastwood directing, Kevin Costner in a movie. And on the first day of the movie, Clint said, okay, Kevin, you got to run through the door. There's a whole lot of laundry's going to be hanging down. You're out to get your girl, whatever. You're running from the guys or whatever. Come out the door, run through the laundry, and go off camera. And Kevin Costner did it. And Clint said, okay, let's move on. And Costner said, I want to do it again. I didn't feel that. I'm not sure. I'm going to try this. And Clint said, look, it's just laundry. You know, I mean, that's my kind of director. So, and I met him last year, and I said, please don't die before you can direct me in a movie. And he said, you first. But there's the other side of it, which is a director like Clint Eastwood really knows what he wants. He really understands film. And he also understands that most actors are self-indulgent, and if he lets them, you know, they'll want to do it again and again and again.
You've been listening to NPR specials from the American Academy in Berlin. Actor Frank Langella discussed his career on stage and his Oscar nomination for his performance in the 2008 film Frost Nixon. For more information about NPR Berlin, please visit nprberlin.de. And for more information about the American Academy in Berlin, you can visit americanacademy.de. The recording engineer for this program was Malte Mau. Our production group includes Mitch Eaton, Kingsley Smith, and Sarah Richards. For NPR Berlin, I'm Neil Conan.